The following is a Sunday feast Bhagavad Gita lecture given by Srila Rindasrup Das on February 9, 1992, in Philadelphia.
Which is called Contents of the Gita Summarized. This verse, verse 22, is a text in the very first lesson that Krishna teaches Arjuna the difference between the self, the soul, and the not-self, the body. This is text number 22. We'll chant this mantra, spiritually purifying. I'll say each word, and you can say after me, and then we'll do each pada, each line at a time. And that way, we'll become spiritually purified just by the sound of the Sanskrit mantra. And then when we understand what it means, we become more purified. We read the purport, we become more purified. And we actually follow it, we become greatly purified. So we'll start with the Sanskrit. Cessation. As a person puts on new garments, giving up old ones, the soul similarly accepts new material bodies, giving up the old and useless ones. Srila Prabhupada's purport. I won't read quite all of it. Change of the body by the atomic individual soul is an accepted fact. Even the modern scientists who do not believe in the existence of the soul, but at the same time cannot explain the source of energy from the heart, have to accept continuous changes of body which appear from childhood to boyhood and from boyhood to youth and again from youth to old age. From old age, the change is transferred to another body. This has already been explained in a previous verse, 2:13. Yad dehi nos min yata dehi kamaram yovanam jara tata dehantara praptam dhiras tata nahuyate. Someone who's dhira, who's actually sober and wise, he can see. But what Krishna is explaining here, Prabhupada is saying, this verse here that we read today, this explains transmigration of the soul. Prabhupada says, this is an accepted fact. We say, what? So many people don't accept? How can he say, this is an accepted fact? He said, yes, everyone has to accept because Komara Yovanam Jara. It's happening now. Right now, you are transmigrating. You're transmigrating through this body. You're the same individual. The same subject is there. The same consciousness is there. And yet, a child, a youth, middle-aged person, old person, your body has gone through so many changes. Even your mind has gone through so many changes. Yet you're the same person. So right now you're transmigrating. So the fact of transmigration of the soul cannot be denied because it is going on around us. We are retaining the same identity, the same consciousness. Sometimes people claim, oh, I'm not the same person I was. Sometimes that will happen. A criminal will be caught. 10 years ago he committed a crime. 10 years have passed, now he's caught. So he may get some psychiatrist to testify. He's not the same person, but they will not hold up in the court of law. You were the same person. It's good that you've improved, but still, you're responsible. So the same identity is there. That identity is the fact of consciousness, that even though my body has changed so much, and even my mentality and my mind has changed so much, still the same consciousness is there that is undergoing all these changes of body and mind that are happening to me. So that persistent identity of consciousness through all these changes, that is the soul. So this transmigration is going on now. That is why Prabhupada said it is an accepted fact. He said even the modern scientists who don't accept the soul, they have to accept that this change is going on, and we stay the same identity. So Krishna explains this. If now you can see in this life that you are the same person even though undergoing such a drastic change, what's the difficulty in understanding that when this body is old and useless, the same soul can again go on in another body? It's the same kind of change. It's not some huge leap. It's the same, he says. So here the example is given. It is just like changing clothes. Your clothes become old and worn out. You take them off and you put on fresh garments. You remain the same person, but you may look very different. You take off your sports clothes and put on your coat and tie. Sometimes people won't even recognize you. Still, you're the same person. So we change clothes. So this is the same way that the soul takes off one body and puts on a new one. This is transmigration. This was at one time actually preached by the founding members of Christianity. Origen, Saint Clement of Alexandria. These people, these early Greek writing, Greek-speaking church fathers, they're called, actually accepted transmigration of the soul. Only later it was condemned in council. It was thought that if a person thought they had many lifetimes in order to reach perfection, that it might make them procrastinate, and so it was not a good teaching to propagate. So the idea was you only live once, and then it's either heaven or hell when it's over. This has backfired, however. People say, oh, it's too hard, I'm going to hell anyway, I might as well have a good time. And they give up. So this is an important idea, a transmigration of the soul. More and more people accept it because it is the only thing that can explain so many things. I know from experience that among Christian theologians and thinkers, the most difficult area they have to deal with is what they call the problem of evil. There's a whole discipline called theodicy, which is dedicated to solving, or thinking about, not solving, no one solved it, this problem of evil. And this problem is cast before the thinker in the form of a dilemma. St. Augustine, who thought about it a lot, put it in the logical form of a dilemma. He put it like this. We grant that there is evil in the world. Bad things happen. He says, either God cannot or God will not get rid of this evil. If he cannot, he is not all powerful. If he will not, he is not all good. So that's the challenge, you see. Somehow or other, one wants to uphold that God is both all-powerful and all-good at the same time. So the problem of evil forces you, if you want to keep that God is both all-powerful and all-good, to figure it out. Because, easy enough, if God isn't all-powerful, he means well, but he can't quite run everything. So that explains everything. There was a man that became very famous. Maybe he still is. I see his books come out. This Rabbi Harold Kushner, not Krishna, Kushner, wrote a book called Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. And this book became a bestseller because his solution was that actually God isn't all-powerful. He said he had to choose one or the other. Either God was bad or God was weak. And he preferred to believe that God couldn't quite do everything. So if you're suffering unnecessarily, if all your life you've been good, you've obeyed all the rules and regulations, you've done everything right, and suddenly your child comes down with an incurable disease, and you wonder, why has God done this to me? You should understand that he's just a little weak. He doesn't control everything. And you have to forgive him, Krishna says. In the same way, he says, you have to forgive him. Just like when you grew up, you discovered your parents sometimes made a mistake and you had to forgive your parents for not being perfect. So the same way, you have to forgive God and love him in spite of his weaknesses. That's what he says. This became a bestseller in America. That's one solution to the problem of evil. This man himself, he was a rabbi, like a priestly person. He had been very good follower, I guess, according to his own testimony. He was working for God. And he had a 14-year-old son that died of a terrible disease. I forgot what it's called, premature aging. He was like an old man when he was 14, you know, died of old age when he was 16. And so from this terrible experience, he couldn't understand why the God whom he loved should do this to him and to his son. Even if I did something bad, he said, what could my son have done? So this is a big problem. The other thing is just to accept, yes, God's all-powerful, but he likes to see people suffer unjustly. Every time this problem comes up in Christian circles, that this is the big stumbling block, the suffering, apparent suffering of innocent people, or maybe they did some little thing wrong, but the consequences is so overwhelming, and they can't see why it is. And God did this. Especially innocent children, they think like that. Well, this is big part of the problem is due to this poor fund of knowledge. You're not. Everybody thinks we are born innocent. No. That's not the case. I remember when I was a child, there was a movie actor who played gangsters all the time, Edward G. Robinson. Noticed for a very tough face, dark beard, and a cigar in his mouth, you know. So there's some film I remember seeing where for some reason or other they had to disguise him as a baby to get him out of town, you know. Put him in a baby carriage and they put this little baby's hat on his head and everything. So here was this little baby with a bottle, you know, with this gangster face. So the little babies, they may look innocent, but actually they may be a gangster. They're not so innocent. Because people have a past history of their good and bad deeds. And so we don't know very well what that history is. But that good and bad karma is coming. And so that explains, gets rid of this problem. Otherwise you have a very difficult period of time figuring it out. What is God up to making all of these innocent people suffer so much? So not so innocent. That's the problem. Not so innocent. So this changing is taking place. It can be seen. There's a lot of research going on. It's become more and more in the United States, more and more people are believing in transmigration of the soul, reincarnation, as time goes on. There's been some empirical research done on this matter. Of course, mostly what you hear about are hypnotic things, hypnotic past life regressions, where people are put into hypnotic trance by a hypnotist, and then they recall past lives. And some of these are fairly extraordinary things, because people under hypnotic trance will start speaking, you know, 13th century German or something like that, which they would have no knowledge and things. However, the most rigorous evidence is being compiled by a professor at the University of Virginia. His name is Ian Stevenson. And he doesn't do hypnosis, because it's a little suspect, because under hypnotic trance maybe there can be kinds of suggestion, or maybe people are reading minds, or, you know, there could be different things going on. He looked for people who consciously had memories of past lives, and tracked down and did research, and found many, many cases where their memories very exactly corresponded with actual events in the fairly recent past. There's no other way to explain this. So he published a series of books. A very cautious, conservative thinker, not given to wild theories, tests things in a very, very rigorous way. So those books are coming out. Nobody has been able to explain these things. His most recent book, he has managed to somehow or other coordinate, show a series of pictures of people born with very strange birthmarks, not just discolorations, but sometimes puckering of the skin and things like that, and relate these to violent deaths in an earlier time, and show, has a series of pictures comparing these birthmarks with fatal injuries. And I've talked to, the book isn't published yet, but I've talked to people who've seen it, and they said it's one of the strangest, most amazing books that they've ever seen. I mean, the degree to which birthmarks and things like that exactly resemble traumatic, deadly injuries is uncanny. So this kind of research is going on, and it seems to be a fairly hard body of evidence that that people will have to deal with someday if they really want to think about it. And of course, for ourselves, we don't need all that research. Here Krishna says, you know, Dehi nos min yata dehi sam sijyanani yata vihaya. Krishna knows what's happening. This is better evidence than any amount of research and books that are written. He's explaining how it happens. He's the author of the universe, and he knows how it works. So this transmigration of the soul is going on. All this by way of explaining to Arjuna that the soul cannot be killed or harmed or hurt. Different principle. The soul is eternal and the body is temporary. Not the same thing. If we're eternal, we're here unchanging, and the body all around us is changing. The soul has no beginning or end. Na hanyate hanyamane sharire. He's not slain when the body is slain. So they're two quite different things, ourselves, the soul, and the body in which we are temporarily encased. It's very little more permanent than a change of clothes. It should be regarded in the same light. You put it on and you take it off. And it's really of no more consequence than that. Our problem is we identify ourselves with the material body. We think we are the body. This is called Maya or illusion. So we don't want this process to be going on. We think that whatever happens to the body is happening to me. We become attached to it. We lament when it becomes old and useless. When it gets hurt, we think this is happening to me. The moment of death is a very, very important thing. We're like sometimes, I remember when my children were very little, like 3 years old, sometimes they would get attached to a certain garment, like a shirt, and that's all he would want to wear. You know, so when it gets so dirty and filthy, you have to take it off and wash it. It was a big trauma. He didn't want to take it off, you know, because he was so attached. So we grow attached to this temporary material body. So when the time comes to change, we lament. Krishna is trying to explain, there's no birth for the soul, he says. There is no birth or death at any time. There's no coming into being, nor going out of being, not in the past, not in the present, nor in the future. That's who we are. It is not that we are a body and we have a soul. This is still the bodily concept of life. You may believe in a soul but think it's just some kind of ghostly or subtle addition to your body, kind of hovering around like an invisible balloon tied by a string, you know, exiting the top of your head or something that you can't see. Something like that, a ghostly pancreas or hypothalamus or something. No. You are the soul. And you have your body. Because people who think like that, that I am the body and I have a soul, like many Christians, you talk to them, they'll think, oh yes, I have a soul. What they think is that they die and their soul lives. So what do they care what happens to the soul? You know, it's just like donating a kidney or something. You know, it just goes on. No, you're the soul. But this identification of the body is that even when people hear about the soul, they still don't understand. That's you. Because this bodily identification is so deep. Liberation means becoming free from this identification with the material body. It means, actually, there's two liberations. There's the liberation from the gross material body at the time of death. We change bodies. But actually, when the soul is transmigrating, something else is transmigrating along with him. Something called the shukshma sharira, or the subtle body. The mind. We call the mind. The mind stays with the soul as long as there are material desires. The mind becomes full of material desires, and at the time of death, those desires that are still in the mind impel us to take a new material body. So at the time of death, one body falls off, and the mind has so many desires to enjoy in a certain way. And because of that, another body forms about the mind. This whole process, Prabhupada goes on to explain in the purport, we don't have time to read it tonight. This whole process is governed by the super soul, the Paramatma, who is situated in the heart of the soul and sees the desires of the mind. So there are so many material desires still in the mind at the time of death. I die in a state of frustration. I want another cigarette. I've never seen Paris. Whatever. Whatever material attachments I have, my mind is full of them. I have to take birth again. It's dangerous business, you know, what you're thinking about at the time of death, what your desires are. Say I've become attached to my little pet dog, Fifi. And all I'm worried about when I'm on my deathbed, who will walk Fifi? Who will walk Fifi? Somebody will walk me. So this is what happened, the desires that we have at the time of death. And all our life, maybe we've been stockpiling so many desires. We've wanted so many things and we've never been satisfied. If our desires are not satisfied, they still stay there. So who knows? Maybe our desires are really nasty. Then I can take birth in a really nasty form of life. You want to know why there's so many nasty, disgusting things? I understand that there's a video series that you can rent now. I guess it ran on television. I don't know who did it. A nature series that shows animals mostly killing and mating. The Time Life did a series that is a kind of a nature porn or something. I didn't see this. But I understand it's a series of videos where they follow lions, tigers, sharks, snakes, whatever, and show their sex life and how they eat. And it's nasty. It's not for nothing they're called animals. They're really nasty. So you wonder why there are animals like that. So that's because people have nasty desires. And if a human being doesn't, we're shocked. But if some little insect does it, we think, oh well, you know, nasty little creature. We don't think too much about it. For the insect, it's legal. So the difficult thing this is to free the mind of material desires. Because we are liberated at the time of death from the gross material body. But then there's the desires for material enjoyment. Again, they come. And Krishna explains later on in the Bhagavad Gita. He said it's like the air carries aroma. So the subtle body carries the desires of the living entity. And then by the arrangement of super soul, you get a new body is assembled. And you get the right kind of mouth, or snout, or proboscis, or muzzle, or whatever. Just to fit your desires, you know. So this is the process by which transmigration takes place. Now those who are wise, by the way, Krishna says, those who are wise can see this happening. But those who are not, they're bewildered. The wise can see this happening. So the wise actually want to stop the whole nasty business. There's no satisfaction in this. So one has to become free, liberated from the subtle material body. That's the process. how to do that. So in Srimad Bhagavatam, the process of bhakti yoga is described. It's described in the Bhagavad Gita. In Srimad Bhagavatam, there's a verse that says that bhakti yoga, or devotional service to Krishna, dissolves the subtle body of the living entity. When bhakti yoga is performed, one develops his spiritual potentialities. Right now, our desires and our body have evolved in a material way. But when we use our mind and body in Krishna's service, our spiritual nature develops. Our spiritual mind, our spiritual form starts to develop. And as a consequence of that, the gross material body and the subtle material mind they dissolve. So that at the time of death, the concentration of the mind is on Krishna. There are no material desires. In our life, in Krishna consciousness, we try to mold our lives so that after a time, our only desire is to serve Krishna. And our only thoughts are about Krishna. And everything that we see and everything that we do is connected with Krishna and reminds us of Krishna. So the whole content of our mind is one thing, Krishna. At the time of death, there are no material desires left. All our desires are Krishna. Our emotional life is tied in completely with Krishna. Then we do not take birth again in this material world. The subtle body is liberated from the subtle body, and therefore that's gone, and there's no more gross material body. That's the process of bhakti yoga. So I better stop there, we're going a little late. Any questions about this topic? Yes?
Sometimes we see people who come to what is called temple and maybe spend a year in devotional service and follow the rules and regulations. And we see that they also leave and engage in bhakti yoga to that extent. How can we understand that if the soul body is being dissolved,
Well, things happen, you know. It's like you can do. Sometimes people do two things at once. They try to light a fire with one hand and try to put it out with the other. And so, different things can happen in Krishna consciousness. So the subtle body, to some extent, may be dissolved, material desires may go away, but again they can recapture the mind. That we've seen, people have ups and downs. And so one may make a certain amount of progress in spiritual life, and then due to being unable to give up certain material desires, or being able to sustain a level of commitment to spiritual life, again succumb to material life. So that can happen, that we've seen. But the setback is only temporary. Someone comes to devotional service, it's because it's a continuation from previous lives. It's understood that for most people, it may take many, many lifetimes of practice before one is fully qualified to go back to Godhead. So in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna asked Krishna about this. What happens if somebody makes it only so far and then stops? Isn't he wasted everything? I spent 15 years, 20 years, trying to be a devotee, and ultimately I go back to a materialistic way of life. What have I got to show for my 20 years? I'm poor, and I have no spiritual advancement. I didn't make money, and I didn't make any spiritual progress. What happened? This is what Arjuna asked Krishna. Isn't it better to not to, at least make money or something, accomplish something material? And Krishna says, no, that's not the case. He said, because that progress that you made for those 20 years, that's your eternal asset. He says, anyone who does good in this way, does something auspicious like Krishna consciousness, is not the loser. And he never loses out. So even if I've only made, 10% progress in spiritual life, that remains. And my next life, I'll start at 10%. So sometimes we see that people are, obviously it's true that many, many more people become attracted to Krishna consciousness than are initially able to follow all the principles that we see. And so what will happen to those people? Well, to whatever extent you can follow, follow. If one slips and falls down, pick yourself up and keep on going. You think 20 years is a long time? A person who's... How many births have you had in the past? Thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands. And you're discouraged because for 2 years, something bad happened? No. One time, there was an associate of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu who committed some offense. And it was received from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu some chastisement and some anger. And it was announced that he wanted to come back and see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, not for 10,000 births. When this devotee heard that he would be able to see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he danced in ecstasy. He said, only 10,000 more births and then I can see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu again. He had some idea of how long. He said, only 10,000 more births. So he wasn't discouraged. So we shouldn't become discouraged.
On that same note, you've given a lecture before on how people leave, come 18, come to the dream 18, and then go on for about 10 years, and then leave. And you made analogy, when they become 40 and 50, and can't enjoy anymore, you just say, well, come back.
Yeah.
Do you think that it's that kind of rejuvenation at that age?
Well, yeah, sure, because people give up on spiritual life sometimes because they get seduced by Maya. And the material energy makes the material world look good. It has this potency that it says you can come in the material world and you can have a good time and it will be very nice. That's why so many people are, involved in material life, because in fact it's not true. Certified by the Creator, Dukalayam Ashasvatam. The material world is temporary and miserable. But somehow or other we think, oh, this is nice. Even though Krishna is certified temporary and miserable. So especially, you may think when you're young that it's really nice. When you start to get 40, 50, 60 years old, the great lesson of old age is one learns about the material world. And one's ideas of the prospect for material enjoyment start to become a little more realistic. So actually, if one is a devotee of Krishna, he'll learn a lesson from growing old, a very valuable lesson. And he'll understand just what material nature is like and just what happens in the material world, how it is very difficult actually for any length of time to be happy in material nature. So those people will then remember their former instructions. Oh yes, I heard about this. I remember this now. Janma Mrityu Jya Vadi Yavyadi. Yeah, what is that? Yeah, birth, death, old age, and death. They're right, after all. What am I going to do? So then people will remember and come back to Krishna consciousness. That I think you'll see. There's no loss. And even if they don't have that realization, then again, they'll take birth and they'll be attracted to the principles of Krishna consciousness. So they're, when we preach Krishna consciousness, when people take up practices, even if it's not very permanent, still the seed has been planted, and you may have to wait a little while for the harvest, but they'll come back to Krishna. Yes?
Isn't it, there is another verse right in the same chapter where Lord Krishna calls such people as pretenders, the people thinking about consciousness.
A person, he says, deludes himself and is called a pretender who has renounced the object of the senses but still mind dwells on them. There's two things in this way that we should understand. Most of us who are practicing Krishna consciousness discover that we have in our hearts material desires. One surrenders to Krishna, but still there are material desires. Now, what am I supposed to do about this? If I'm a sincere devotee, there may be material desires there, but at least I have targeted those material desires for destruction. I say, these material desires in my heart, they're the enemy, and I want to get rid of them. The desires are there, but I'm doing everything and I'm praying to Krishna to get rid of them. That person is not a pretender, even though they're material desires. The person who is a pretender is the person who says, oh yes, I'm becoming free from material desires, but in his heart, he doesn't try. He makes accommodation. He tries to think that while on the external way, I'll appear very renounced, on the other way, I'll try secretly to be the enjoyer. He doesn't give up, doesn't try to give up his material desires. When we speak of the offenses against the holy name, one of them is to maintain material desires, even after understanding so many instructions on this matter. Not to have complete faith in the holy name, and to maintain material desires. So the offense is not having material desires. Sometimes that will be there. What can you do? The mind is full of material desires. And you may think you've cleared out so many material desires and then out pops another one, you know. That may be there. The offense is maintaining the material desires. So the one who maintains these desires, while outwardly has claimed to renounce, but his mind is still thinking, how can I satisfy, how can I satisfy? That person is a pretender. We better stop. It's time for prasadam. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
The following is an excerpt from a Srimad Bhagavatam class given by Srila Rindasrupa.